When Bethany Joy Lenz stood in a West Hollywood hotel room with her 11-month-old daughter, she made a decision that would change everything. After enduring her husband's hour-long tirade and watching her baby's eyes grow deadened from the emotional assault, something shifted within her. This wasn't just another marital dispute. It was the culmination of years spent under the psychological control of a manipulative spiritual leader who had systematically isolated her from family, drained her finances, and convinced her that obedience to him was obedience to God. The star of the hit show One Tree Hill had been living a double life that even her most devoted fans couldn't imagine. While portraying the beloved character Haley James Scott on screen, off camera, she was trapped in what she would finally acknowledge as a cult. Her memoir, Dinner for Vampires, has become a cultural touchstone for understanding how intelligent, successful people can be drawn into high-control groups, resonating particularly with those who've experienced religious manipulation or coercive control in relationships. Joy's journey toward vulnerability to manipulation began in childhood. As a young girl moving between four different Texas cities in 8 years, she struggled to maintain friendships while witnessing growing tension between her parents. Between this volatility, constantly changing schools, and undiagnosed ADHD, she found salvation in a community theater in Arlington, where she was cast as a munchkin in The Wizard of Oz. Performance seemed to be in her blood. Her great-grandmother had run off to join the circus and ended up in vaudeville, while her paternal grandparents were show folk. Her grandmother, a choir director and regional actress, her grandfather, a Broadway performer in original productions like South Pacific and Carousel. During visits to her grandmother's New Jersey home, Joy would explore the attic filled with playbills, records, and theatrical memorabilia, feeling connected to her family history. The Arlington Community Theater gave Joy her first sense of belonging. She thrived in the creative chaos of rehearsal rooms, costume shops, and dance studios. During The Wizard of Oz, she improvised a moment showing her character's dislike for Toto, earning audience laughter and discovering she could impact an entire crowd's emotions. On stage, she could escape her problems and be anyone she wanted. The eccentricities that caused trouble at school became assets in acting. As her talent developed, Joy starred in local productions, received a highlighted review in the Dallas Morning News at 12, and was cast in her first on-camera role in a Christian film. After joining a school for TV and film, her mother arranged her first trip to Los Angeles, where she received positive feedback and reached the final round of Mickey Mouse Club auditions the same year as Britney Spears and Justin Timberlake. Before her grandmother died of cancer, she gave Joy career advice. "It's a hard life to be an actor, but there's nothing more glorious than being able to tell stories." She hugged Joy close and said, "Sing your heart out, kiddo. One day, your name will be in lights." After her parents' divorce and subsequent remarriages, Joy moved to Manhattan at 18 after securing a series regular role on the soap opera Guiding Light. She quickly formed a band that played at legendary venues like CBGB and The Bitter End, booked a TV movie as Mary Tyler Moore's daughter, and auditioned regularly for Broadway. Her deepest friendships formed at church, first at a small South African pastoral couple's apartment, then at Redeemer Presbyterian under Timothy Keller, whose intellectual approach to faith reminded her of her father's teaching style. When her Guiding Light contract expired, she chose not to renew it, hoping to advance her career. Despite numerous near misses with big studio films and mounting financial pressure, she remained determined to succeed. Moving to Los Angeles full-time revealed its strange, disconnected nature, a sprawling city without the community she'd found in New York. Though she booked guest spots on TV shows, the city's ego-driven, competitive atmosphere made everything feel like a struggle. With strained family relationships and few friends, she felt profoundly alone until her roommate Mina introduced her to a Bible study at the Van Hewitt House in North Hollywood. The modest home was always open Saturday nights for gatherings aimed at industry people who might not feel comfortable being vulnerable in traditional church settings. Every Saturday followed the same pattern. Pam, the mother, hugged each person at the door, followed by hugs from everyone else. Abe would strum his guitar as a signal to gather, then lead worship songs before reading scripture. These gatherings became the highlight of Joy's week, with the group of 15 forming close bonds but extended beyond Saturday nights. 6 months into attending the Bible study, Joy met Les, a sweaty, red-faced man massaging salt into raw meat with his hairy fingers in the Van Hewitt's kitchen. He was introduced as a pastor from Washington near the Idaho border who was going through a lot of transition because his congregation was falling apart as a lot of people weren't ready to grow. Les became a regular fixture at the gatherings, gradually taking over leadership. During one visit, he cooked Peking duck while revealing he'd been a Marine sniper in Japan, showing off his Semper Fi tattoo, one of many fabrications Joy would later discover. After preaching on Isaiah 43:25 about forgiveness, Les explained his philosophy. Rather than pointing out others' flaws, we should speak the positive truth of someone's identity. When Joy questioned if this approach seemed condescending, Les fixed his gray eyes on her and insisted, "Don't let people get away with seeing themselves as anything less than utterly loved by God," adding, "We must stop being selfish." During a group prayer, Les unexpectedly singled Joy out, asking everyone to stretch their hands toward her. "I'm envisioning you in a pawn shop," he said, "and I just feel like you've been telling yourself for a long time that you're second best." His words pierced her core wound with surgical precision, bringing her to tears. The group embraced her with tissues and affirmations of, "Love you, sis." For the first time in her life, Joy felt she didn't have to put on a show to belong. What Joy didn't recognize was how Les was already implementing classic cult recruitment techniques, identifying emotional vulnerabilities, creating a sense of special understanding, and positioning himself as uniquely qualified to provide healing. When Joy's father expressed concern about her new spiritual direction, Les comforted her by saying, "Some people just don't have spiritual ears to hear, especially people stuck in a certain religious routine with God." His validation reinforced her commitment while subtly undermining her relationship with her family. Just as Joy was becoming more involved with Les's group, her career took a dramatic turn. Despite initially dismissing her manager's suggestion to audition for a Warner Bros. Teen drama called Ravens, later renamed One Tree Hill, Joy reluctantly went to the screen test. There, she broke convention by moving furniture and sitting on the table instead of using chairs, immediately energizing the room. The scene became transformative, no longer acting, but a moment where Joy and Chad became Haley and Lucas. She was cast immediately. Joy felt anxious about leaving her spiritual family just as she'd found them, but Ed, the Von Hewitt patriarch, prayed to give her permission to be excited, transforming her anxiety into creative energy. What she didn't realize was how this geographic separation would make her more vulnerable to the group's influence, not less. As One Tree Hill gained popularity, Joy found herself trapped between worlds. Les had conditioned her not to seek advice from non-believers like the show's hair and makeup artists, yet she couldn't confide in family members who had no experience with fame. She feared Les would interpret her desire for a successful career as sinful validation-seeking from Hollywood rather than God. Meanwhile, Les and Kurt, another family leader, visited Joy in Wilmington but stayed only one night, claiming leadership responsibilities limited their time. Their real purpose was asking for money for a hotel property, presenting Joy with a Kinko's printed pamphlet featuring a Quality Inn and conference center with the words, "A dream come true." Despite her financial advisors warning against it, Joy was swayed by Les's embellished stories of his past spiritual leadership and miraculous healings, authorizing a $10,000 investment that would be the first of many financial entanglements. Les's control over Joy and other family members intensified through an increasingly sophisticated and formalized hierarchy. The group meticulously structured itself like a pseudo-religious organization, designating parents and children in a spiritual hierarchy that mimicked biblical patriarchal systems. At the top, Les and Martine, along with Pam and Ed and Kurt and Lucy, formed an official leadership council called the Hamatzah, which Les claimed was Hebrew for council. This leadership structure created multiple layers of authority that members had to navigate, making it increasingly difficult to question or challenge decisions. During a pivotal group meeting, Les orchestrated a comprehensive presentation on spiritual authority and rebellion, carefully distributing detailed booklets titled Rebellion Against Authority. These materials were filled with carefully selected biblical references and contemporary examples that reinforced the group's authority structure. When Joy sought clarification about these teachings, Les delivered a masterfully crafted response, weaving together biblical narratives about Moses, David, and Paul to demonstrate how even the greatest spiritual leaders had earthly authorities. He emphasized that questioning authority was equivalent to questioning God himself. The hotel investment scheme revealed another layer of Les's manipulative tactics. When Joy innocently questioned whether the property was actually a motel rather than a hotel, Kurt's disproportionate reaction about being devalued created an emotional pressure point that Les expertly exploited. He skillfully redirected the conversation by praising Joy's hospitality gifts, painting a vivid picture of how the hotel could become a ministry center where she could fulfill her spiritual calling. To add credibility to the venture, they strategically revealed other investors, including Dante's mother's substantial contribution of $75,000 and Ed and Pam's $50,000 investment. The $10,000 they pressed Joy for was presented as a minimal commitment compared to others, making it harder to refuse. The manipulation reached its peak when Joy received the Broadway opportunity to play Belle in Beauty and the Beast. This wasn't just any role. It represented the culmination of years of training and childhood dreams. Les orchestrated a sophisticated campaign of emotional and spiritual manipulation, framing the decision as a spiritual test of loyalty. He conducted private meetings with Joy, describing vivid spiritual insights about her future and suggesting that choosing Broadway would mean choosing worldly success over spiritual growth. When she showed signs of resistance, the family implemented a coordinated silent treatment campaign, completely cutting off communication. This isolation tactic demonstrated the devastating emotional consequences of choosing independence over the group's control. Text messages went unanswered, calls were ignored, and Joy found herself completely cut off from her support system. The collective pressure worked. Joy declined the Broadway role, believing she was making a noble spiritual sacrifice. It was only later, after gaining distance from the group, that she recognized Les's true motivation, maintaining absolute control over her life decisions and preventing any opportunity that might lead to independence or external influence. The episode demonstrated how thoroughly Les had developed his ability to manipulate not just individuals, but to orchestrate group dynamics to achieve his controlling objectives. After 6 months of rehabilitation, Dante was declared cured of his porn addiction and readmitted to the family. His wedding to Jasmine was back on, though instead of accepting his mother Esther's offer to pay for a nice ceremony, Les insisted they hold it at the motel conference center with its shabby carpet and fluorescent lighting, wanting wedding photos for promotional materials. When Abe and Emily became a couple, Joy felt desperate about being alone and developed a convenient crush on QB, the only remaining single man in the family. She confided in Les during a counseling session, who responded by subtly encouraging the match, telling her she was beautiful and could have anyone, while also noting QB was handsome. Les clearly informed QB about their conversation as he immediately began pursuing Joy. Though they officially started dating, their relationship lacked chemistry and compatibility. QB was sweet but naive. He didn't know who Marilyn Monroe was and thought people who traveled for leisure were snobs. Despite their fundamental differences, Joy tried to convince herself that his innocence was exactly what she needed, desperately wanting to follow what she believed was God's plan for her life. During a visit to Wilmington, QB proposed to Joy after they were caught by Les being intimate. Though Joy initially resisted, she felt trapped and sought divine guidance. When she heard what she interpreted as God saying, "If you choose this, I will make it good," she accepted, more out of fear of losing her family than genuine desire. Several family members, including Mina and Harker, expressed concern about the match, offering Joy a way out while assuring her she wouldn't lose their friendship. But Les forbade anyone from speaking against the engagement and sent Pam to counsel Joy, who dismissed her concerns about lack of chemistry by saying, "Attraction comes and goes." Les convinced Joy that her Hollywood-influenced ideas about love were shallow and that obedience to God should come before emotions, which would fall in line later. The wedding itself felt like a performance to Joy. Standing at the altar with Les officiating reminded her of the many TV weddings she'd filmed. As she went through the motions, she imagined a fantasy rescue scenario where Blue Eyes would interrupt the ceremony and whisk her away. Les notably skipped the "if anyone has good cause" part of the ceremony, perhaps knowing several guests might have spoken up on Joy's behalf. The honeymoon proved disastrous. Joy discovered that sex made her feel sad rather than creating the chemistry she'd hoped for. The evangelical purity culture's promises about marital intimacy proved false, leaving both of them frustrated. By the end of the trip, Joy realized she'd made the worst decision I'd ever made. QB's controlling behavior extended to dictating Joy's clothing choices, claiming tight jeans were trashy and would attract other men's attention. When Joy tried on alternative outfits, he rejected each one with absurd reasoning. Skirts were easy access, button-down shirts could be ripped open, and yoga pants were completely forbidden. After an hour of trying on clothes and QB repeatedly postponing dinner, Joy sat crying on her closet floor, feeling defeated. With QB restricting her acting opportunities, Joy developed her own project, a musical adaptation of The Notebook. Working with Grammy-nominated producer Ron Aniello, she created a bluegrass swing music version she dreamed of taking to Broadway. Though QB forbade her from playing the lead role, he allowed the workshop to proceed in Wilmington. Despite their interference, the workshop performances were successful, moving audiences to tears and attracting five Broadway producers who made offers. However, the project mysteriously stalled in legal negotiations for months, then years. Joy later discovered someone had undermined them by claiming she lacked Broadway experience and was involved in a cult. 6 months into her pregnancy, Joy returned home to find their beautiful Craftsman house in complete disarray. During an explosive argument over finances, QB had unleashed his fury, throwing a heavy metal laundry basket against the wall with such force it left a gaping hole. Their terrified dog cowered under the dining room table as QB stormed onto the wraparound porch, systematically destroying her carefully tended terracotta planters before speeding away in his truck. Joy's hands trembled as she called Emily, who rushed over and was horrified to discover the true extent of QB's volatile anger issues. As Joy methodically swept up broken pottery and soil, her carefully maintained facade finally crumbled, and she confessed through tears that these violent outbursts had been a regular occurrence throughout their 5-year marriage, each incident followed by profound apologies and promises to change. The situation reached a breaking point when Joy returned home with newborn Rosie. Emily had stopped by unexpectedly and found herself witnessing the aftermath of one of QB's most destructive episodes. The sight of Joy, still recovering from childbirth, attempting to clean up dog waste while navigating around broken furniture and shattered glass, sparked Emily's intervention. "This isn't just a bad temper, Joy. This is a serious problem," she insisted, even as Joy attempted to minimize the situation with practiced excuses about QB's stress levels and work pressure. After One Tree Hill ended and their Idaho restaurant venture imploded with mounting debts, Joy orchestrated what she hoped would be their escape. She carefully planned a trip to Los Angeles, telling QB it was to meet with potential new management teams, but secretly intending to discuss their extraction from Les's influence. However, the plan derailed during a catastrophic argument in their hotel room, where QB's reaction to her gentle questioning about the family's control became so threatening that Joy grabbed Rosie and fled the hotel room in terror. QB's immediate return to Idaho alone, seeking guidance from the very people she was trying to escape, forced Joy to finally confront what her parents had been saying all along. She was trapped in a cult-like situation that was destroying her life. In a last-ditch effort to save their marriage, Joy made a simple request: 1 year without seeking the family's counsel. QB's flat refusal and his detached response, "I'll do what I have to do and you do what you have to do," provided the clarity she had been seeking. In that moment, looking at his unmoved expression, Joy found the strength to utter the word she had been avoiding for years: divorce. The decision, though heartbreaking, felt like her first breath of freedom in years. After a grueling 3-year legal battle costing roughly $360,000, Joy finally won custody of Rosie, with QB receiving only visitation rights. This victory hinged on her father's research and testimonies from numerous victims, including Alice, a former foster daughter who revealed disturbing abuse by Kurt that Les had covered up. When Joy checked her bank account balance, she was horrified to discover only $220,000 remained. After calculating what she should have after years of earning around $1 million annually, she realized approximately $2 million was missing. Despite her substantial earnings from One Tree Hill, most of her money had vanished. Despite her anger at God during this ordeal, culminating in a balcony meltdown where she screamed profanities at the heavens, Joy experienced a spiritual reconnection, remembering the voice that had told her years earlier, "Never doubt that I am real." That same presence returned, explaining it had spoken then so she would recognize it now, when she needed it most. What made Les dangerous was how carefully he avoided typical cult hallmarks, making it easier to dismiss concerns. The DA ultimately didn't pursue a case because fewer than 70 people were involved, not deemed a public threat. This reinforces the misconception that only stupid people join cults, when in reality, intelligent and ambitious people are prime targets because they respond to high expectations and challenges. The one true identifier of a cult isn't alien beliefs or strange rituals, but the notion that anyone who questions or disagrees is unsafe. For mind control to work, there must be heroes and villains, us versus them. In a cult, safety means agreement. Joy found irony in how the cult TV show, One Tree Hill, outlasted the actual cult it inadvertently helped her escape. By sharing her story, she helps others understand the complex psychology behind staying in harmful situations and demonstrates that recovery is possible, even after years of manipulation and control. Her journey from vulnerability to strength serves as both warning and inspiration, a testament to the resilience of the human spirit and the power of truth to ultimately prevail over deception. At an Entertainment Weekly party, Joy reconnected with Camille, who initially seemed wary until Joy bluntly stated, "Well, I'm not in a cult anymore." Her genuine relief and embrace contrasted sharply with another encounter at a Los Feliz birthday party, where a former friend dismissively suggested only stupid people join cults. Joy challenged her perspective, drawing parallels to abusive relationships and helping her understand the complex psychology behind staying in harmful situations. These interactions taught Joy the importance of sharing her story honestly. Most people's first question when she mentions her cult experience is, "Which one?" disappointed when it's not one they've heard about in sensationalized media. She learned to lead with, "They stole over $2 million from me," to satisfy their morbid curiosity. In writing her memoir, Joy found both healing and purpose. Rather than condensing her experience into sound bites after casually mentioning her cult experience on her Drama Queens podcast, she decided to write a comprehensive account. The process of revisiting this chapter of her life was terrifying, but ultimately liberating, allowing her to reclaim her narrative and help others understand the insidious nature of coercive control. These interactions taught Joy the importance of sharing her story honestly. Most people's first question when she mentions her cult experience is, "Which one?" disappointed when it's not one they've heard about in sensationalized media. She learned to lead with, "They stole over $2 million from me," to satisfy their morbid curiosity. In writing her memoir, Joy found both healing and purpose. Rather than condensing her experience into sound bites after casually mentioning her cult experience on her Drama Queens podcast, she decided to write a comprehensive account. The process of revisiting this chapter of her life was terrifying, but ultimately liberating, allowing her to reclaim her narrative and help others understand the insidious nature of coercive control. Joy's story reminds us that we are all little cathedrals of contradiction, where darkness and beauty coexist. Her journey through manipulation, abuse, and financial exploitation to eventual freedom demonstrates that recovery is possible, even from the most sophisticated forms of psychological control. By courageously sharing her experience, Joy transforms her personal trauma into a beacon for others still trapped in similar situations, proving that even after years of being silenced, finding your voice can be the most powerful act of rebellion against those who sought to control it.